Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel LaRue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for another episode. This episode is a version of The Eliminated, which focuses entirely on the Chicago Bulls. I was lucky enough to secure two guests that I really wanted to have on, and that they were able to and wanted to record together. So we have Brian Schroeder of Hardwood Paroxysm and Bulls by the Horns, and Nate Duncan of Basketball Insiders. And we go really in-depth on the Bulls. We go all sorts of topics with the free agent possibilities this summer, Nikola Mirotic. And that first part of the conversation went a little bit over an hour, went on a lot of different topics. And then that evening, so this was Saturday night, Sunday morning, Adrian Wojnarowski reported that the Wolves were considering moving Kevin Love for the first time and that the Bulls were a serious possibility in terms of getting him. So the three of us talked, and we decided to record another little session. So we did 25 minutes on that. So it totals about an hour 25, plus or minus a little bit. One of my favorite conversations I've ever had on the podcast went in a lot of fun directions. And each of us gets challenged, and we say our own pieces, and we have differing opinions. And I let the Bulls experts do what they're going to do. But it was so much fun to do. I really hope that you enjoy it. We had an absolute blast recording both days. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
So I think the best place to start with the Bulls is to get a little bit of a sense of where they're going to be going into the summer salary cap-wise, and I figure might as well start with Nate on that.
Is this before or after they re-signed Kirk Heinrich to the full mid-level exception?
Let's say it's before.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, let's see. Let's look at who the free agents are. Kurt Heinrich, obviously, is a free agent. And then he's really the only major guy. I guess DJ Augustin is the other one. And then, you know, sort of more bit players like Jimmer Fredette. And then, of course, there's the issue that Carlos Boozer might be amnestied. So those are the main guys, at least the only ones that I have on my spreadsheet that I created for this that I think the Bulls might consider bringing back.
Brian, who do you think they'll bring back, if anybody, of that group?
Well, you know, if Heinrich managed to take a huge pay cut and sacrifice for the team to take the full MLE, I'm sure the Bulls will have him. Just he'll be back. It's I can't imagine he won't be. Just the way everyone in the organization talks about him, his value is lower than it's ever been, so I don't think they're going to have many suitors for him, unless the Bucks feel like outbidding themselves again. So it's hard to envision him not returning unless they get incredibly aggressive and try to get Melo and Mirotic and Lance Stevenson out. Unless they just come back with incredible depth, he's going to be back.
So, Brian, where do you fall on the level of Kirk Heinrich hatred among Bulls bloggers? Are you sort of at like a zero, you know, he's actually okay, or are you at like, you know, full-on Bulls blogger level 10?
I oscillate. Sometimes there are times, specifically the first like 4 months this past season, I was probably like a 14 on the scale of 1 to 10. but I'm okay with him. He was playing, he played all right the last 6 weeks or so. I mean, he shot significantly better. He wasn't shooting in the, you know, low 30s. So he was a lot more bearable. He wasn't shooting 11, 12 times a game either. He was shooting, near the end, he was shooting a lot less than Augustin was, and it worked. So I'm okay with him as the fourth guard he should be, which is what he should be, but I don't know. My biggest problem with Heinrich is less him than it is the perception that he's still good and useful, and he's not really.
Yeah, but my position on him is, yeah, if you want to bring him back at the minimum, absolutely. If you're going to at all create any kind of opportunity cost by paying him more than that, then it's not a good idea.
That makes sense. But so, yeah, in terms of the free agent class, we'll get into some of that later. But the big question for me with the Bulls is Carlos Boozer. And so I want to phrase it to you, and we'll start with Brian, in the form of two questions. One is, what would you do with Carlos Boozer if you were in control of the situation? And what do you expect the front office to actually do?
I would amnesty him. Just not even because he's a decidedly average player, but the options they have this year, none of them will really work without amnestying him. So that for that reason alone, he'd be gone. And that's why I assume that they'll amnesty him. Seems like they will. Seems like nobody – I don't really understand who in the organization is going to have his back. Not like he's burned bridges or they all hate him, but Tibbs obviously isn't the fondest of him. He just prefers to play Gibson. And it's not like you never really hear about – you know, compared to Heinrich. Heinrich's kind of the golden boy. You never really hear anyone in the organization defending Carlos Boozer too aggressively. So I imagine he'll be gone.
I mean, I think it's fait accompli that he's going to be gone. It better be. I think. I mean, there's just there's no possible basketball reason. You know, Bulls fans love that term after Gar Foreman used it to justify some of the departures in the summer of 2012. But there's no basketball reason for him to be on the team next year. I think they're, and this may be getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I think either one of two things needs to happen. Either they trade him for Carmelo, and if the Knicks are willing, and the Bulls would probably have to throw in some more assets to do that, I think I would be willing to do so because that would enable them to stay over the cap and use their full mid-level exception, potentially on Nikola Mirotic and maybe even to shoehorn someone else in there. So that would be number one. And then if they can't do that, then you got to trade him. If they simply trade him away with an asset to do nothing but just get under the cap, that would be pretty criminal in my view. And though I'm someone who has defended the organization throughout the years against the accusations of cheapness, because I think most, if not all of their, well, probably not all, but most of their moves, you know, such as not re-signing Ashiq, are justifiable for basketball reasons. If they give up an asset to just dump Boozer and they don't get Carmelo in return, that would be basically just totally emphasizing financial profits over what's best for the team on the floor.
Do you agree with that, Brian?
Yeah. I also think that Kelly Dwyer wrote once that it's not as though the Bulls are obviously making decisions based on finances. It's sort of on the back burner. It's sort of an inspiration for everything. And each individual move is justifiable, but together it all kind of paints a picture that there is a sense of cheapness that probably shouldn't be there for a team in this market. But
yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing because I know that the Bulls, their ticket sales have been good and things like that. And the other interesting parallel is that the Warriors in some ways established a precedent of unloading an expiring contract and paying basically you could say they gave up two first-round picks to do two contracts, but, you know, giving up a first-round pick to give up a bad contract. And the Bulls have two of those, but I think that would be more egregious considering they have the amnesty there to work from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, I mean, that was the whole problem with the Warriors. They wasted the amnesty, and so they had to pay. I mean, I agree.
So we'll move on to free agency, and as we've said, the Carlos Boozer situation looms over that. And Carmelo's already come across, but we'll leave Mirotić aside for a second. What players that are on other teams do you think would make sense if this team has some cap space to work from?
The three guys that I would target, one is Carmelo, obviously. And then after that, I don't think you can leave out Mirotić because you need to. He is someone who, if your only option is to get Carmelo by going under the cap, then you're probably going to sacrifice Mirotić, and that's, you know, all right, you have to do that, even though I really like him a lot. I think, though, you need to assume that you're getting Mirotić because then you look at the team needs. They don't really need a big man at that point because they'll have Gibson and Noah and Mirotić, and then Greg Smith, and you know, maybe they can get another big man at the minimum. So you're really looking at guys at the 1-3 positions. And to my view, other than Carmelo, the only two guys that I really would want to spend up to, you know, over $7 million a year or so on for this team are Kyle Lowry and Isaiah Thomas. Now, people might say, well, wait a minute, you know, they already have Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose is big enough that I think he can competently defend most two guards in the league. It's not really that strong of an offensive position these days. They're going to have Jimmy Butler on the roster to really take whoever the tough wing guy is for the other team. So, and I think even if Derrick Rose does get caught in a tough matchup, if he's healthy, which is, you know, pretty much what the assumption has to be going forward for this team, because so many assets are tied up in him. If he's healthy, then he should be able to blow by whatever bigger guy is guarding him. And so what I like about Thomas and Lowry is both of them can shoot. And then also, if Rose is injured, then you still have a pretty decent point guard as well. I would love to see this team with two guys who can attack off the dribble. And as I said, both those guys can shoot, which is something that you really need if you're going to be playing Rose and Butler at the same time along with them.
Brian, are there any other names that you're intrigued by?
Well, as far as bigger free agents go, I think Lowry is sort of the ideal if Melo is not an option. And smaller free agents, I mean, the problem with bringing back Heinrich is that there's always going to be better options, and I think Sean Livingston would be a good one, or potentially Grievous Vasquez. I'm not really sure.
I just don't like anyone who can't shoot. Like, if you can't shoot threes, I'm not interested in signing you this summer.
Brian Roberts might be available, and he'd be a nice fourth or fifth guard. But
yeah,
you know,
I'm just thinking
of guys who would fill out the roster at the end.
No, I mean, that's a different conversation. But yeah. I mean, if you're going to be a major guy and you can't shoot, I'm not interested in you, because the Bulls just have too many guys like that already. It doesn't matter if the guy himself is good in and of himself. He's not going to work with the guys they already have in the roster, because they're just going to be facing a packed in paint all the time.
Well, you know, Kyle Lowry is not a world-beating shooter, but I think he
almost 50% of his shots from three this year.
Yeah, he's become more of a shooter lately. But I don't think there's any chance at all. But Gordon Hayward still hasn't signed his extension, has he?
No, and the other name that I'm guessing it's a no, but I wanted to throw out there just for my own amusement, is Luol Deng.
Well, I mean, I'd be happy with it, but I don't think anyone else would be.
Yeah, I considered that too, and the reason I'm not interested in him is because, again, just the lack of shooting. They just need someone who can shoot the ball. I mean, if they had Mirotić as the starter, maybe Deng, if he were going to come back on a true value contract after they struck out with everyone else, might be okay, because Mirotić shooting at the four would add so much. But, you know, Mirotić isn't going to be, you know, he's probably only going to play half the game at most with Taj Gibson there, who obviously deserves a lot of playing time as well.
Can Taj log, how many minutes a game would you feel comfortable with him logging as the center, so like theoretically Taj and Mirotić playing together?
I'm not sure of any. I don't know. Taj plays a lot bigger than he is, but he's not that big.
I think he'd be fine against the other team's backups.
Yeah. Most backup centers aren't going to be longer than he is, so yeah. But, or the ones who aren't going to be able to do anything with it. Like, Yan Mahimi's not going to be scoring on Taj Gibson like crazy. But that's unfair. That's my bias towards Greg Smith, who is a lot bigger than Taj, but he's also not very good defensively.
So the other kind of elephant in the room, we've already talked about him a little bit, is Nikola Mirotić, and Nate wrote a piece on the salary feasibility of that, and I was hoping for those who haven't gone through it yet, Nate, if you could walk through quickly just the challenges with a guy who's coming, who was a first round pick but is now outside of the scale possibility. Well, he could be scaled, but he doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I think really it might help us just to get some context for all this of what the Bulls' salary structure is. I sent you guys around a spreadsheet last night. So basically, I added a few assumptions. If the Bulls were to amnesty Boozer, and then including the fact, and the assumption is that Joakim Noah's, if he made $500,000 this year for his incentive as Defensive Player of the Year or First Team All Defense, I can't remember which one it was. So that means then that incentive is going to be included in his cap number next year. So he goes up by $500,000. If Taj Gibson makes Second Team All Defense, which he is expected to do in some circles, he makes $250,000 this year, so his cap number goes up by $250,000 next year. So including that, and then I also assumed that Heinrich is renounced, or because his cap hold would be well over $4 million, which would be quite throttling. So if he's renounced or immediately re-signed to the minimum, you know, so he's basically off. And then DJ Augustine, I assume that he was going to be renounced because the Bulls don't have his bird rights anyway, so you might as well have the rookie minimum cap hold of nobody on there, which is $507,000, instead of his cap hold, which would be a little over $900,000. So assuming all of that happens, and then you also, the other issue is whether Mirotić's cap hold comes on or not. That would be about $1 million. So assuming that all of that is on there, that leaves the Bulls with a team salary of a little under $53 million. The cap is projected to be at $63 million. So they've got about $10.2 million in cap room to sign people after Boozer is amnesty. So that's sort of where we're starting from here in all of these discussions. So now with Mirotić, the issue is that he has a buyout with Real Madrid of 2.5 million euros, which is about $3.4 million. And he also, so his rookie scale amount, which would be a little over a million, that's not going to get it done to get him over here because he has to pay for the buyout essentially out of his new contract. So what's going to happen then is he needs to get, if they're going to sign him, they can go above the rookie scale, but they need to do at least a 3-year contract to do that. That means that they cannot use the $2.7 million room exception for teams that are under the cap because that contract is limited to 2 years and probably wouldn't be enough to entice him anyway with that buyout. So their two options for bringing over Mirotić are either getting under the cap, like we talked about, and using some of that cap room on him, likely $3.5 million at a minimum, possibly more, and or they stay over the cap, like in the scenario where they trade Boozer for Carmelo and then can use part of the mid-level exception on Mirotić. So those are your two ways of getting Mirotić here.
Yeah, and it's definitely interesting because the other factor that lingers over everything is the idea of the moratorium. So that means that while they do have to make the decision early in terms of amnesty, they do have that window to kind of see where things are going before everything actually has to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much Mirotić. So Brian, do you think that he's worth it to bring over? Let's say it takes $4 million to bring him over. Is that something that you're okay with in most circumstances?
Well, yeah, I just feel like it's time to bring him over. It was time to bring Ashik over when it was time, and that worked out pretty well. And it just, he needs to be over for his sake. He needs to come over because he's not going to be able to get his big payday like Nate wrote if he doesn't come over quickly. It'll take longer and longer the longer he waits, obviously. And he's 23. He needs to, it's worth seeing what kind of asset he is at this point. And I'm not really sure what else he can do. I know he likes playing in the EuroLeague, but I'm not really sure. He's sort of kind of reached the pinnacle of what he could be there, I think, at least from what I've seen.
They're actually playing in the final of the EuroLeague Final Four tomorrow against Maccabi Tel Aviv. They're going to be pretty massive favorites in that game. So if they win, there's been some talk that would make him more likely to come over since he would kind of has accomplished what he would have wanted to in Europe, and what you said about his motivations as far as getting over here, getting that first contract over with is a good point as well. And I think that given the skills that he has shown, there may be an adjustment period, But I, as I've made clear so far, I love shooting. He's a stretch four. He's just an absolute knockdown shooter. You know, there are going to be some questions about his defense and probably his defensive rebounding, but he is someone who could really, really goose the Bulls offense. And because the Bulls have some limitations on how much they can pay him, and also the fact that they have his draft rights, so he's the only one they can, or the Bulls are the only ones that he can negotiate with, that means that they're going to get him for a much cheaper contract than he could get on the open market. And I think spending money on him is going to be much more cost effective, getting him at a number like $4 million, even $5 million. I think on the open market, he might be an $8 million a year player. So you're just much more effective spending money on him than you are really on any free agent except for potentially Carmelo.
Yeah.
So I would say unless the Bulls are – the only way to get Carmelo is to go under the cap, jettison a few more contracts, get to about $15 million, and then Carmelo is willing to start at $15 million, which, you know, he probably wouldn't be, but maybe he is. Unless you're going to pursue that specific scenario, I want that cap room, some of it used on Mirotić, because it's the most efficient way to use it.
I feel like I agree. If they're going to be that aggressive and go after Carmelo and Mirotić, and I'm all for it, but... I'll believe that when I see it from the Bulls. The next time that they're really aggressive in free agency and snatch up all these big targets will be the first time. So, but I feel like there's a lot of people who think the Bulls should take Doug McDermott. If he's available, he wouldn't be. And Mirotić is that player, but probably better, and he's much larger. So I just feel like he fits, and it's time.
Well, and the other thing that I find really interesting about the possibility of the Knicks making the deal with the Bulls is that the Knicks don't really have functional cap room. So if they make the decision that they don't want to make the long-term commitment to Melo, which I actually think is justified, I've written that before, it would be a very interesting move to get Boozer. But then the other question is, what would make sense as a sweetener there? Because obviously they're doing a favor to a team in their own conference, and Boozer, by all accounts, is overpaid. So what kind of sweeteners would you guys be willing to put in there to make a deal that makes sense for both sides?
Probably anything below Taj Gibson. Certainly the two first-rounders, I'd be willing to do that if it meant getting Carmelo. And that's realistically, I think, at least from the Bulls and Carmelo's perspective, that's probably the only way to do it, because that's really, unless they get rid of Taj Gibson, which I would not be in favor of, that's really the only way to pay Carmelo $20 million or above, is if they either trade and extend him or sign and trade. Now, of course, whether Phil Jackson, I don't know that many 68-year-olds who are really that interested in playing the long game. So maybe Phil Jackson, you know, is just not going to do that. And, you know, Jim Dolan, even more so, probably not willing to do that. But in terms of what would be fair to give up, because you also remember now, if you do the trade, you're enabling Mirotić to come over a year earlier as well, because now you can sign him to the mid-level exception. That's the only scenario, if you do that trade, under which you can get Mirotić and Boozer. So I would be willing to throw in both first rounders this year, or maybe one first rounder this year, one first rounder next year, or I might be willing to even go as far as trading Jimmy Butler, who, let's remember, is about to get a lot more expensive with him being extension eligible this year and a restricted free agent next summer, as long as the Bulls could get back one of New York's wings who is at least somewhat competent, because they're going to need some wings as well. So yeah. I would be willing, because that scenario enables you to get both Carmelo and Mirotić, I'd be willing to give up quite a bit.
I feel like the two first-round picks would be just kind of, at least one of them would be necessary. I think most of the haul from the Deng trade would probably be possible. Yeah, anything short of
Taj.
That's
true. I forgot they have those still in the future, too, so that makes it easier to give those up. That's a good point.
I'm not crazy, but unless they got, I guess, Shumpert, but I'm not sure about Butler for Shumpert. That seems like a lateral move, but... yeah, anything short of Gibson's really, really fine. Trading Boozer and Gibson for Melo, it seems kind of pointless. unless there's something about Taz that we don't know. But I feel like that would be probably fair. I imagine the Knicks wouldn't do that. Just as you mentioned, I imagine Dolan wouldn't want to do that. But I also don't think Phil is exactly enamored with the concept of Carlos Boozer, but it's possible. It's possible. The Knicks, we don't really know what their plan is, so you could see.
Well, and the thing with the Knicks is that they're probably, I don't think if there's any real way that they're going to get any big free agents other than Carmelo this summer. So
no.
Basically what that allows them to do is it allows them to be more relevant next year without committing any bad long-term money to Carmelo. And so that's an interesting idea, though I think if they're going to go that route, why the Bulls need to add sweeteners is that they could move Carmelo probably, unless he has a horrible year. They could just trade him next year to a team with space and then, you know, trade him in 2015 to a team with space and get assets unless the Bulls give up more to make that happen now.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about at the trade deadline in 2015?
Yeah, or after the season itself, you know, maybe they arrange a deal during the moratorium, and then because let's say they have conversations with Kevin Love or somebody else, and they say, hey, you know, if we have space, would you be interested? And then some team is going to see Carmelo as an asset. I actually was talking with Amin Alhassan of ESPN about the idea of the Nene test, and it's basically, is a guy's value enough that you consider him an asset on his contract? And I think it's hard to argue that even at the max, as much as I think that he would be overpaid, that there wouldn't be some team that would be sitting there going, hey, we can get Carmelo. He doesn't have a no trade. That sounds pretty great. So I think they'd be able to find somebody.
Well, it all depends on, and this gets into something else you wanted to talk about, where your team is in the success cycle, right? I mean, I think for the Knicks, where they are right now, if they gave Carmelo his true max, which I haven't looked at it recently, but I think, you know, that's going to be 22, starting at 22, 23 million. He's probably been making about 30 million by the end of that deal, 5 years, and he's 30 right now. That's going to just kill the Knicks, right? That's going to be a massive overpay. Like, that's just going to leave them where they are, and it leaves them with so much of their cap clogged up that even if they have this 2015 plan, they probably aren't going to be able to execute it because Carmelo is making so much, just like Kobe is making so much now.
Yep.
For the Lakers. For the Bulls, a 4-year contract, which is the most that they could give him, starting at his individual max, makes a lot more sense because the Bulls realistically could compete over the next 2 or 3 years, and it doesn't matter as much that Carmelo is probably going to be pretty massively overpaid starting in year 2 and certainly year 3 and year 4 of that deal, because they're in a situation where, you know, they're going for it. And if Derrick Rose is healthy, that's a very bona fide championship contender over the next 2 years, with Melo and Rose, and then Noah and Gibson, and hopefully Mirotić as well.
And maybe Jimmy Butler too. So let's go. I know we don't want to go too specifically into the draft, but just if there's anybody who's caught your eye as making sense for this Bulls team, or anybody that's caught your eye in the negative way of saying, oh, you know, that guy's popular, but I don't think he makes sense with this team. We'll start with Brian.
Well, TJ Warren's been bounced around in there, and I think that'd be... he can't shoot, so I'm not sure if he's the best idea. Well, I don't know if he can shoot. He doesn't shoot. But he's one of the strangest prospects, because he's a three. He's barely bigger than Jimmy Butler, but he scores at the rim, you know, in transition at the rim, at a level that's just frankly ridiculous for the college level. And it would translate, but I waver on him because he like I said, he doesn't shoot. But And I'm not sure if he's any good defensively at all, but he'd be an interesting guy. He'd help with the wing depth, and he could play small ball four, kind of. But I'm more interested in Adrian Payne from Michigan State, or even Nick Stauskas from Michigan, if he makes it there. I doubt he will. People seem to think he's Cal Corver, so that I doubt he'll make it to 16. But Adrian Payne, I think, is becoming my primary target because he's huge. He's listed at, what, 6'10"? 6'9", 215. He's not 6'9", 215. I've seen him standing next to people. He's not that small. He can shoot. He's got really big hands. He can defend. He'd be a great, if they're not sure about Greg Smith, he'd be an ideal fourth big. I think anyone would take him as a fourth big.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at the film quite enough to say who I actually think is good. I mean, I'm familiar kind of with what guys are supposed to do, but I haven't looked enough to determine, come up with a good opinion of whether they can actually do that or not. I think when you look at, let's assume that they get Carmelo or they get someone like Kyle Lowry, or even if they don't, I think it's instructive to look at what the team needs would be in that situation. They're still, if they get Carmelo, they're still going to need a backup point guard who can score and distribute a little bit. And they probably, it would be nice probably to have one more wing guy who can shoot or a big guy. But I mean, when you, if you, if they really were to get Carmelo, I mean, obviously the draft occurs before that, but the Bulls will at least have some sort of a plan going forward. I think they just need to take the best guy available, because this team is going to be good enough that you're either looking at someone who's going to develop a little bit and help the team down the road as someone like Rose and Noah and Gibson age, or you're going to need someone who can play right away regardless of what their position is. So, I mean, I still think, especially for the Bulls now, because they're, that's a team that probably is not going to have a ton of holes, at least on paper, before everyone starts getting injured, that you just need to take whoever the best player is.
Well, that's, Adrian Payne is much, he's 23. He can play right now. He's one of the older guys in the draft. And
yeah, certainly his skill set is very intriguing, at least what it's advertised to be.
The other thing that's interesting about Adrian Payne potentially on the Bulls is that he has this really weird medical condition where his lungs are actually too small for his body, and that's a problem in certain in certain circles, in terms of that it might prevent him from playing heavier minutes. But the Bulls would be looking more for somebody who can be effective in less minutes, assuming they keep their general big man core together. So, of course, injuries can happen and things like that, but that they would be asking for about the right things from Payne, which would be a very good fit, as opposed to some other teams that might be more flawed and would need more from him. Let's move on to, Nate already alluded to it, what, one of the things that I'm very interested in, and I phrased it for years, is the timetable of contention. And so basically the idea is, how close is the team to their peak, and in the Bulls' case, they might be there now or be there at the end of the summer, how long do you think that will last? So it's just kind of, you know, if you were building the team and maximizing that, what would be your thoughts on that? And we'll start with Nate.
Well, as I said, I think this is a team that can contend, assuming that Derrick Rose can even get back to, you know, 85-90% of what he was. Now, that's perhaps a dangerous assumption considering how much time he's missed. You know, Doug Tonas, who does a nice Bulls podcast himself, has mentioned the fact that he can't think of any player who's basically missed two full years and come back to play at a superstar level. The only one I could think of is Michael Jordan, but, you know, he didn't miss because of injury. He just missed because he decided not to play. So, but I think with the amount of resources that are tied up with him, you have to make the assumption that he is going to be that championship level player, going to be at least a top 30 player in the NBA. And you got to go for it, because you're not doing anything else with him on your books for the next 3 years, and championships require risk. And so you need to just act like he's going to be himself and go for it. And then if he doesn't, then you'll have to reboot 3 years from now when he comes off the books, or, you know, maybe trade him in the last year of his deal or something like that. So I do think if Rose can come back to be what he is, you're going to see, you're probably going to see decline from Noah and Gibson. Those guys are, you know, a little bit older than 27, which is when guys usually peak, 25 to 27. And Noah especially is very dependent on energy and athleticism. I think that this is, we probably saw both his and Gibson's best year, but you should expect improvement from Butler. You should expect improvement from guys like Tony Snell. Hopefully that'll all, and, you know, Mirotić coming over as well. So he's someone who I think is only going to improve, especially as he gets into an NBA weight program. So I think really over the next couple of years that this team should be able to stay at a pretty similar level to where they're going to be next year, and that they should treat it. The decision-making should be that we're going to try and contend in those years.
There's not really anything else to do. I don't know what else.
Yeah, exactly, right?
I don't really know what the other plan would be, just to stand pat, stay with this roster, and just hope things, hope that Derrick Rose is better than he ever was before. I don't really know
I mean, nobody's going to take him at this point. So, there's nothing else to do but take the opportunity you've kind of built for yourself through some frugal spending and through people finally realizing how average Carlos Boozer is. Just get rid of him and go for it. There's nothing else to do this offseason, really.
Do you guys have a feel yet for – thinking about this for a little bit in terms of how they are going to fit in with whatever Miami might do next? Because Miami's aging – I feel like Miami's aging faster than Chicago would be if with the cores that we've been talking about early, during the rest of this conversation.
Well, yeah. Miami's role players are all fairly old. So they if they keep their big three together, they'll reload. You know, you can replace Shane Battier at this point. And you can – I don't know if you can replace Ray Allen and have him still be Ray Allen, but you can replace, I mean, it's not like you can't find another guy to do what Birdman does, and Mario Chalmers is replaceable, who's not even that old. Odin's replaceable, so especially if Miami wins this year, you're going to see guys, some of these mid-level guys head there. It'll happen.
Yeah, what they're going to do is just, that's a whole separate podcast on its own. I think a lot of it depends on Wade. He's someone who is owed another $20 million for the next 2 years. He has the early termination option this year, but there's no way that he's going to be worth that $20 million the next 2 years. So is he going to opt out and maybe take a longer deal for less money? Is he even willing to? Even if he takes a longer deal for less money, let's say he takes, you know, what would you pay him? Say, you know, 4 years, $48 million. So that's over 4 years, gets him $8 million more than he, or really $7 million more than he'd make over the next 2 years if he stays opt in. Mm-hmm. And you would have to imagine that he would make more over those next 2 years after his contract expires than just $4 million a year. So financially, there's no way it really makes sense for him to re-sign. It basically is just going to be a question of, or when I say re-sign at a lower number, it's basically going to be a question of what's important to him. If he's willing to basically, you know, punt on what's probably going to be at least $10 million, if not more, by re-signing at a lower amount, and then are LeBron and Bosch willing to do the same? If they are willing to do that, then it's going to be big trouble for everyone else who's trying to beat Miami. But, you know, there was a talk about them taking less when they came over. That was like $2 million a year less. That wasn't $8 million a year less. And really, yeah, the only time in NBA history that I can remember guys taking that much less than they're worth, well, I guess there's two. One has been this recent San Antonio. Maybe Dirk is going to do it this year with Dallas from what he's talking about. And then Gary Payton and Karl Malone going to the Lakers in the summer of 2003. Those are the only times I can really think of that people have taken that massive of pay cut, so it would be relatively unprecedented. I don't think they're going to do it, but I would be very impressed with them as people who are really concerned about winning if they do, and it would also terrify me as a Bulls fan.
Well, the thing to think about with that is that when Gary Payton and Karl Malone went to the Lakers, they were essentially a shoo-in for the title. Like, that was almost a given that they were going to win, or at least be in contention, and they were. And the Spurs, you know, they're always in contention. So especially if they win the title this year, I think that I would be surprised if it happened because, I mean, those three obviously enjoy playing with one another. You know, you never hear Wade or Bosch complain. No, Wade doesn't complain that LeBron leaves the team. I mean, they're all friends, and if they win three titles in a row, that's pretty good incentive to stay together for a little while longer. So I think the more terrifying thing is if Wade leaves, you might be able to replace him at this point. I mean,
hard to imagine that, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think he's the least likely guy to leave, honestly, because he's the guy who has this the possibility of this identity of being the guy for that franchise, and he has the possibility, despite not being the best player at his own team for the last few years, to be the most identified player in the history of a franchise, and I think that's a really cool distinction. Even Paul Pierce never had the chance to get that distinction. Well, he's great of a player as he was for Boston. There's a certain cachet with that, and you lose some of that if you willingly leave.
Yeah.
I got a question for you guys. I don't mean to hijack it, but this just occurred to me. I think it's interesting. If you are a Bulls fan And presumably, as a Bulls fan, you want Miami to be as bad as possible in future years. Do you want them to win the title this year or not win the title this year?
Just with the way players think, I feel like if they didn't win the title, they'd be more likely to break things up. Just, oh, well, we obviously hit a wall with this group. Especially if they lose to the Pacers. Like, I can see that they would kind of, I don't know, maybe Pat Riley wouldn't overreact, but he is Pat Riley. But I could see them not winning this year. It just feels like players obviously don't think, and I don't mean this to be an insult, they aren't as forward-thinking, you know, with cap situations or with you know, 3 or 4 years in the future, who will be making what, as we are. It's not, there's no reason for them to be. So winning a title feels like, you know, like, why not, we just won 3 titles in a row, why don't we do this again?
The way that I'd phrase it is that it depends on who you think is the person to break up the big three. If you think that it's Bosch, I think that you would want them to lose this year because I think that would lead to him having a wandering eye. Yeah. If it's LeBron, which is who I think it is, I think you want them to win. So then he opts in for this year or for 2014-2015, and then at that point there might be a situation that intrigues him enough. And at that point he will have already gotten a three-peat, so then that whole legacy would be there, and then he's, you know, you could do the whole thing of, oh, I've proven what I can prove there, and I'm going to do something else, and that would open up the possibility. But if you're a Bulls fan, that might open up a possibility of him going somewhere that would be even better than the Heat would be. You know, if he combines with Kevin Love, or heaven forbid he waits another year and combines
fine.
With Durant.
But there's nowhere in the Eastern Conference that LeBron's going to go that scares me more than where he already is. At least I think there's, it's sort of high risk, high reward, right? If they win the championship this year, I think it's more likely that, you know, everyone could just opt in again, or that they decide, okay, just having these three guys as our main guys is good enough. That's probably one of the better scenarios for the Bulls going forward, because LeBron, he's slipped a little bit this year. Wade obviously slipped a little bit this year, and he's you know, obviously LeBron's still awesome, don't get me wrong, but he's not as good as he was last year or the year before, I don't think, especially in his floor game. And Wade is going to go downhill. Bosch is probably going to continue to decline. I think he's almost 30 now, or he may even be 30 at this point. So if they just continue to roll with those three guys, I think that actually, and kind of fill in around the margins, but they probably won't be able to that much, especially if those guys all opt in, then I think that's probably a decent outcome for Bulls fans, other than just having to watch the Heat win again. But then if they lose, it could be great because LeBron just leaves, or Bosch leaves, or whoever. But it could also be really bad because then they reload a lot around LeBron with some younger guys or more talent, even, you know, if Carmelo even goes there or something like that. So it's kind of a high risk, high reward if for a Bulls fan, if the Heat don't win it this year. But also if they do win it, then you're probably ensuring that those guys stay together, which is also bad, but, you know, maybe not the absolute worst outcome.
The other thing that I wanted to ask both of you, as guys who also, I think, watch a fair amount of the Eastern Conference, is let's take the Heat aside. Of the other teams that are out there, so I would guess this would be more the Pacers and the Wizards, though there could be other teams involved, which of those kind of more on the rise teams do you think is the biggest threat to any success that the Bulls might want to have in the conference?
Washington. I think that's a fairly obvious answer. Washington's probably the most. I mean, we'll see what the Pistons do. If Stan Van Gundy can be not Joe Dumars for a couple of years, and maybe they won't be signing these people these terrible contracts. But Washington's probably the big one. I mean, they just handled the Bulls without Rose, sure, but they just hammered the Bulls in a 5-game series. So, I mean, I don't think Toronto's going to be getting much better. You know, it's going to be a while before, like, Philadelphia or Orlando is any good. The Knicks aren't going to be much of a threat. The Bucks. Maybe Atlanta, because Al Horford was hurt, but I don't really know what else they're going to be doing. They have a lot of space and they have some picks. The Celtics have some picks. Yeah, most of the teams that are contenders in the East this year are either very old or just, you know, that hit their ceiling, like Toronto.
I agree with you on Toronto. They're Well, they do have some young guys. They could be a little better. It depends, obviously, if they re-sign Lowry and for how much money. It's going to be a really interesting offseason for Masai Ujiri. That what might be one nice thing about potentially signing Lowry for the Bulls. And, yeah, actually, I guess as a quick aside before we get back to that, what do you think of my plan, Brian, of bringing in either Isaiah Thomas, or Lowry and rolling with essentially a two-point guard lineup? What do you think of that? Is that good, or is that going to be too much of a problem?
Well, I'm a little biased because Kyle Lowry and Isaiah Thomas are two of my favorite players in the sport. But, yeah, I'm all for that. Two-point guard looks are never bad. I mean, the Bulls ran with a two-point guard look for significant portions of games this year, and the two-point guards were Kirk Heinrich and DJ Augustine. I mean, I don't feel like Thibodeau would have any problem playing Kyle Lowry and Derrick Rose together. Kyle Lowry can guard most shooting guards, not say any shooting guard. You know, because you said, especially if the Heat stay together, you still, maybe not to the extent the Pacers do, but you still kind of make moves to counter the Heat. And I'm fine with Kyle Lowry guarding 30-plus-year-old Dwayne Wade in the playoffs. Like, I'll take that. Jimmy Butler's still there. He can guard LeBron. I mean, yeah, Kyle Lowry would be kind of a pipe dream almost for me. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, well, so, yeah, what were we talking about before? Oh, yeah, the other East contenders.
Yeah.
If the Bulls got Rose back and he were somewhat the same, the 85-90% Rose we were talking about, even if the Bulls just got Mirotić and then filled in around them, I would say that the Bulls are the clear third-best team in the Eastern Conference next year, possibly even second to Indiana, assuming that Miami comes back in something resembling their current form. The Wizards don't scare me all that much. I mean, I think they're good, but the way that they shut down the Bulls defensively is not something that I think would happen into the future, and I don't think that their offense is going to be quite good enough that it scares me either. Nene is going to go downhill. I think Ariza is not going to be as good next year if they resign. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we don't even know.
It depends on what they do with Ariza and Gortat. But Beal's 20, and Beal was probably the best player in that series. So,
well, and the other thing about the Wizards is that I think Randy Whitman's not a good coach, and I think that Grunfeld's not a good GM, and it seems like their success this year might give them more leeway, which actually could help a team like the Bulls, because that could, if they're still saddled with one or both of them when they're better because they're just getting older, and older is a good thing for them, that would actually be a huge benefit. You know, we've seen it in certain playoff series already this year that a very talented team with a flawed coach can get beat by a team that's similar with a substantially better coach.
I don't know. I think Whitman kind of gets a raw deal personally. He didn't do that much in these playoffs that I thought was just like so egregiously terrible. Certainly, I don't think there's any argument that Tom Thibodeau outcoached him in that first series, and Whitman's pressure scheme really just took the Bulls out of everything that they wanted to do, especially going down the stretch. I thought his rotations were pretty solid throughout they've played good D the last 2 years. So I'm not sure why. I mean, I'm not saying Randy Whitman is so amazing, but he doesn't strike me as an albatross the way he seems to strike a lot of other people.
I think the thing with Whitman is I agree that there's not a whole lot he does that obviously loses them games, but I'm not sure what he does that obviously wins them games. It just seems that he's kind of a non-entity as a coach.
My issue with them is that there are large moments that their offense is just kind of a train wreck, and I think that their Wall is getting better, and I think that they're getting a better sense of what he does well, and Beal's a wonderful complementary piece. I think that he could end up having a bigger role. It feels like they don't offensively go for the jugular and really just kind of take it. Let's say they're doing something well, make a team stop that before doing something else. It feels like they try to get more variety and that they weaken themselves in that sense. And you didn't see it against the Bulls because they didn't really need it, but I think we saw it a little bit against the Pacers.
Yeah.
So I wanted to first, before we close, just make sure there wasn't anything else that you guys wanted to have as a part of this conversation for the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe if we're talking about Lowry or we're talking about Thomas, it might be useful to discuss the mechanics of that a little bit more. I guess with Lowry, one thing you could do is you could also try to do the Boozer trade for him and throw in some assets. I don't think that Masai Ujiri would be willing to do that. It's interesting because that I wrote about this back in February before we kind of knew how the Raptors season was going to turn out, that they are at a little bit of a crossroads. I think the initial intent was to rebuild. Now, if you're going to re-sign Lowry with that team to market value, which is probably going to be something like 4 for $48, then where do you go from there? Is that team going to be a championship contender? They lost in the first round to what ended up looking like a relatively decrepit Nets team. If you keep Lowry, you're kind of putting a ceiling on how good you're going to be. Now, granted, there was so much great feeling for the Raptors with the crowds that they had and people getting back into the team that I don't know that politically, if letting Lowry go and kind of reloading to be good again in 2 years when guys like Valanciunas and DeRozan and Terrence Ross are at their peak, it would be palatable to the people in the North. But I think that was kind of his original plan. So maybe it's possible to throw in kind of the Godfather assets deal of the draft picks and, you know, the draft picks would be the major thing, and Boozer to sign and trade for Lowry and then bring over Mirotić as well. Or just if you're going to sign Lowry outright, then probably if you want to get Mirotić also, then you're probably going to need about $15 million in room. So that would mean you're going to probably have to trade away Mike Dunleavy for some kind of future assets. You have to trade away maybe Tony Snell. It might mean, you know, trading away some of the draft picks to eliminate that cap hold. There are some gyrations, but you could probably get pretty close to $15 million, and then you offer Lowry something starting at $11 million with the maximum 4.5% annual raises, and then you could have Mirotić at about 3.5, 4 million with the maximum raises, which I think he would take because he's actually only making, from the best I could find out of my discussions with people, about 1 million euros, which is about $1.4 million. That means it's more likely that he would take something in the 3.5 to 4 million range, even with the buyout. So what do you think? What do you think happens if the Bulls were to offer Lowry about $11.5 million a year to start with?
I'm not sure what he would do, because I feel like he wants to be the lead guard wherever he goes. That's sort of
that's a great point. Great point.
Like he's kind of that kind of guy. I have a feeling he wants to stay in Toronto. I think he's going to give them every opportunity. And I don't know if it's a bad idea. I mean, it definitely puts a ceiling on them, but like you said, it kind of sends a message to the fan base that they're at least going to try. Because fans are, I mean, let's be honest, fans are stupid.
except the ones that listen to this podcast.
Yes, obviously. No, well, I mean, the Raptors, I guarantee there's a sizable contingent of Raptors fans who think their best course to win a championship is to re-sign Kyle Lowry. So, probably a significant amount of season ticket holders. And it just sends a message that the front office understands why they were successful this year, and they're going to try and replicate that. And I don't think it's a bad idea for a team that's been bad for a while to sort of build up some goodwill and build up a bigger fan base. That's what they need. That's what Pacers needed for the longest time. Pacers had to be none of their fan base loved them. They had to build up goodwill with the community again.
I think that that's a really good point with Toronto, and I think that at a certain point, they would be happy. Obviously, Ujiri has higher aspirations, but hosting a playoff series for another couple of years is pretty good for them. And I think that while there are certainly are teams that are on the horizon that would be better than I think they're going to look, I think we're all in agreement on that they're closer to their ceiling than teams like the Wizards and obviously younger teams like the Sixers and the Celtics and all those and the Magic. But that's not a bad gig, and I think that they're in this really weird place also with their chronology in terms of when guys like Valanciunas and DeRozan are going to get pay raises. They're getting raises sooner rather than later, which means that you're not going to get that success and then that time with cap space to then blow it up. And
well, DeRozan
up
already extended, Danny. So he's
true.
So he's at like, you know, about $10 million a year. So that's I was thinking more about
Valanciunas.
Yeah, I agree with you on him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's gonna get a lot more money, and Lowry's gonna be getting more money too, obviously. And so the big question with them, and there's, you know, next season, they're still paying Landry Fields unless they can find somebody to take him, and which is incredible when you think about all the mechanics that led to that contract.
Oh,
that's one of the more incredible ones in terms of everything. But yeah, I think that, and the other thing, Brian brings up a good point with the lead dog part of Lowry, but I do think that the one exception to that, for a lot of those guys, especially guys that have been in a lot of different circumstances, is stability on a quality team.
Yeah.
I think that what the Bulls would say is they're like, yeah, you're not going to get that, but you're going to be on the team that you can be confident is going to be relevant the entire time you're there. You're going to have a coach that's going to love you, because I think we can all agree that Thibodeau would love Kyle Lowry.
I don't think there's any risk of Lowry not having a role on that team. Like, defensively, he's just like a super version of Kirk Heinrich. Like, and, you know, we know how much Thibodeau loves what Heinrich does defensively. Lowry is that, you know, exponentially so. So, yeah, he would love him. He would play him all the time.
And heaven forbid Rose gets hurt in any extended fashion, then it becomes his team.
Yeah.
And so you have – I think that players are in a lot of ways – I hate to say this, but they're kind of like snowflakes in that they're all very different and they all have different motivations. And so the question, and I think we saw this with Dwight Howard at various points in his decision-making tree, is you just need to find out what argument works with him. And I think that what makes Kyle Lowry's interesting is that the Bulls can make an argument that almost nobody else can make. And so you don't know if it's going to work, but at least you're doing something different, and they're the best at that argument. So if Carmelo doesn't work out, if the other things don't, at least you have something different there, and at least you have the moratorium, so if he says no, he's going to say no before you have to make a big decision on Boozer and anything like that. Yeah. So you can make all those pitches, you can throw everything out that you want, and unless he's going to be ridiculous and wait out until after the moratorium to choose his team, then you're fine, and there's no harm, no foul, and except for Carlos Boozer's confidence, but nobody gives a crap about that. So... that's the one thing that I think helps the Bulls more than anything, is that all of these teams are going to get a sense of, and all the players are going to get a sense of what's out there, and they'll be able to make a decision instead of the dominoes all falling and having to choose which players to prioritize, because you have 10 days or so to figure it all out.
When you're talking about really with either Thomas or Lowry, if the two-point guard lineup obviously has some pluses and minuses. I actually happen to disagree with you, Brian. I think Lowry would not be the guy defending shooting guards, it would probably have to be Rose, because Lowry's really only about 6 foot. I know he's a bulldog and he's tough, but I don't know if he could defend shooting guards as well.
I'd
as
be
Rose
more comfortable with him. I'm not. Rose has never looked very good defending shooting guards.
I think he's off ball.
Rose doesn't really seem to know what to do at the time.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, it might be something that I'd have to retrain it, and it would be. You know, it would be a liability. You're giving something up on defense, regardless, with either Rose or Lowry defending shooting guards. I mean, you just have to sort of hope that there aren't that many shooting guards that are going to hurt you, or, you know, if there is, then they're not going to have a great small forward, and Rose could be hidden on whoever the small forward is, and then hope that they can make it up at the other end, and also just hope that with guys like Gibson and Noah behind Rose that it's not going to be as much of an issue either. I mean, it's not ideal, but just because really, you know, Rose is a point guard, but bringing in a wing, I just don't see anyone available who is a good enough shooter and who is a good enough quality of player that I'd want to spend that type of money on him. So this is the Bulls' one chance to spend some money, get another major piece, get the best guy on the market, and I think you could make it work, especially offensively with Rose and another point guard out there. That's the thinking.
And if we're going to talk about Butler as the third guy, the other thing to consider is that I can't think of any NBA team right now, especially after the Thunder did the Harden trade, that has a strong enough 1-2-3 that there's nowhere to hide somebody. Every team has a flaw somewhere and has a spot. And if you have a guy like Jimmy Butler as the third man in that, let's say it's Lowry, Rose, and Butler, You can put Butler on whoever the other guy in the 2-3 is, whoever the better guy is. So then, while you might have some weird physical matchups, you could have some where guys, as we have some where, you know, maybe Rose, if you're putting Rose on the other guy, has other physical advantages. And so there aren't many teams that can make you pay, incidentally, Miami might be one of them, for having those weird lineups yeah. and for doing those sort of things. And I think that it could be a situation where, especially as we talk about the lack of quality in general with the shooting guard position, where they get the benefit of just having no team having that kind of perimeter depth. And so you're not really – you're losing something, but what you're losing is a lot less important than what you're gaining.
Yeah.
So I guess with the idea of Lowry coming over, I mean, I was thinking about it. I think you're right that he has shown that he has really, like, wanted to be the man. I think it would be okay. I don't know. I mean, he definitely has a very prickly reputation, and that may not be something that the Bulls are down with. But Lowry would start in this scenario, and I don't know that playing next to Derrick Rose is really any different than playing next to DeMar DeRozan, who also has a pretty massive usage rate as well. So, I mean, those seem fairly similar situations. Well, so
from a usage standpoint, I don't think Lowry would have a problem, but DeRozan's not a point guard. I mean, Lowry brings the ball up. Lowry dominates. He doesn't dominate the ball, but he's the point guard. It's just sort of I don't think guys look at their usage rates when they think about, like, being the lead guard. Some guys might. I'm like, Iguodala probably does, but, you know, like...
Rondo might,
yeah. Yeah, and Rondo is the lead. Like, he's obviously been that, but... I just feel like Kyle Lowry would have some – I'm not sure he'd agree so readily. But I also think
– No, I agree with you. It's an issue.
We talked about what the Bulls can offer in, you know, with their pitches. I'm worried that what they think they can offer is, like, sending Lowry a picture of Ron Harper and be like, can you fill this – can you fill these shoes? Like, because I just have a feeling that they're going to assume that Kyle Lowry wants to be that guy because they obviously don't understand – what it is players want if they're sending LeBron, if they're having LeBron sent, you know, Jordan's shoes and his ring cases and all this garbage.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at least they've advanced beyond, like, Benny the Bull meeting Tracy McGrady at the airport. I don't think they're as tone deaf as everyone necessarily believes they are. So what about Thomas? What would you offer him?
Probably less than Lowry, just for the fact that...
For sure.
If Lowry can't guard twos, and Isaiah Thomas can't guard twos, but I do love him. I think he's going to chase the biggest contract he can get. You know, last pick in the draft, had to prove himself. I think he's going to go after whoever gives him the biggest chunk of change, and I don't know if that's going to be the Bulls, but I'd be in favor of it if it was.
Would $8 million be something, Brian, that you would offer him if that was that a little high?
That's the number I had in mind. I think that's what it would take to have a realistic chance of getting him. Otherwise, Sacramento just matches.
Less than that.
He's restricted. Let's not forget to mention that.
I don't think less than $8 million would be anything he – I don't think he'd pay attention to it.
Well,
the other thing I wanted to ask you guys, there's one really interesting CBA thing that we're learning with the Chandler Parsons situation that I think affects with Mirotić. And so the idea is basically if he signs a 3-year contract, then he is a restricted free agent at the end of it. If he signs a 4-year contract, then that is not his rookie scale contract. And Nate, obviously, correct me if I'm wrong. He becomes an unrestricted free agent. And so would you be willing to give him that fourth year, even let's say it's for less total years, but then lose the ability to have re-sign him as a restricted free agent?
I'm willing to do whatever gets him to come over here and take the least amount of money at this point. I mean, I think that's if he wants the extra year. If I were him, I probably don't want the extra year. I think I would be fine being a restricted free agent. And in fact, for restricted free agents who are actually good, I think some research has shown that those guys actually get paid a little more because any offer has to be a godfather offer that's designed to make the team not match. Now, if you're bad, you probably don't want to be a restricted free agent, but because you're just not going to get any offers at all. But if you're good, like he, I'm sure, expects to be, and like I expect him to be, then I think I would go for the 3-year deal.
Whatever gets him over the quickest is the best option because I just signing him to a restricted deal, a 3-year deal.
in 3 years, are we really going to be worried about the cap space in the same way? Like, Roses will be off the books by that point. Like, it's not going to matter either way, I don't think. If the window's not closed by then I guess we can worry about it, but yeah.
It is interesting to me. I'm looking at, you know, the salary structure for the Bulls, and obviously they'll be paying some people more than they already are. But 3 years from now is the same year that Taj and Rose expire. So that would kind of – a three-year thing would also give them some interesting flexibility in terms of knowing what they have and either reloading or just kind of changing around the structure of the team. Though obviously I think we all assume that Noah will be on the books then as well.
One thing we should mention for everyone – I don't know if we did say this. I mean, we know it, but for some listeners who don't, Isaiah Thomas is a restricted free agent. I mean, I guess we touched on that, but we have to make it clear that if the Bulls hope to get him, they would have to offer enough that Sacramento is not going to match it.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless they're willing to take a small asset in a sign-and-trade like they did for Tyreek Evans. But again, that was an issue of the Pelicans offering Tyreek more money than the Kings were willing to pay. They just were able to get an asset in Grievous Vasquez out of that.
I wonder if the Kings want their pick back.
That's a good point.
I mean, that'd be the first thing I'd offer them in a sign-and-trade.
Remember this pick, guys? You used to have this.
And we have seen teams trade back for their own picks before. I remember I was doing a piece on Minnesota, and I was tracking a piece, and I'm like, wait, this is their pick, but it went to three other teams before they got it back. There's something intriguing about that for some reason.
It's a do-over.
Yeah.
It's sort of an undo button, I guess.
So we're doing a little bit of an addendum to this because over the night after we recorded this, Adrian Wojnarowski reported that the Timberwolves are actually considering trading Kevin Love for the first time, and the Chicago Bulls are a team that is on the list. So I think that the best place to start with this is what might be an easy question, but would you rather have Kevin Love instead of Carmelo Anthony, and we'll get into what that means after.
Short answer, yes. The long answer, also yes. It's not really much of a... it's not really much to consider, personally. I mean, I have turned around on Melo to an extent. I thought he played really hard this year, and he's definitely settled into to a kind of a smaller four, better than I think he ever was as a three. But Love is 26 and 13 and 5, almost. Shoots an obscene amount of three-pointers and hits a very high rate without sacrificing his rebounding, his incredible rebounding percentages. And he's just, he's a top 6-7 player, and I don't think Melo is. So it's an easy answer for me.
So you're telling me that the younger, better, and less expensive guy is who you'd be interested in?
Yes.
Yeah, the other part of it with Kevin Love is that he's on the right side of his development curve. You know, Carmelo's 30, and he's going to be presumably getting worse, whether we're talking physically or just, you know, in general. And Love should be getting better. The other part of it to me is that Love fits really well with Joakim Noah, in my mind.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And as you mentioned, Carmelo, the first couple of years, he'll probably be worth whatever salary he gets. Then the second couple years of his contract, he's not really going to be worth it, probably. And Love is someone who, over the next 4 years, even if he's making the max, is very likely to be worth well more than that. So it definitely is a no-brainer to me that should be priority one for the Bulls.
Yeah.
Thinking about then the fact that obviously it would be a trade, and we've talked a little bit about what you would give up for Carmelo, and Nate, we'll start with you. What do you think would be a reasonable starting place for what the Bulls would give up in that sort of trade?
Well, it'd probably almost certainly have to be Nikola Mirotic. And I think that Mirotic is someone certainly that is an attractive asset. The Wolves shouldn't have any trouble paying him an amount that would entice him to come over. There's been some talk about how they would have to get that figured out. I think that they could pay him enough to make it worth it and still have him be a value contract. Carlos Boozer would almost certainly have to be included for salary purposes. But then he expires after 1 year. That's one big thing that could make the Bulls offer, in addition to draft picks, of course, that could make the Bulls offer much more attractive than Golden State's. Because any Golden State deal would likely have to include David Lee, and he goes on for another year after Boozer on a salary that's going to be pretty darn close to dead money by the second of those years in the 2015-16 season. So you got Boozer, you've got Mirotić, and then pretty much, I would say, just about any draft pick that they want. You know, three first-rounders, I would absolutely even go that far. Now, not right away, because there's a question of, are there going to be deals to beat that? And I don't know that even there's another team out there that's also a contender. You know, we can debate about whether Phoenix is that, but that's also a contender that's actually going to beat this offer by the Bulls that I'm talking about, even if it's, say, two first-round picks. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would pretty much be the structure of an offer. Maybe Taj Gibson could be involved, and the Bulls could take back something like Kevin Martin instead, whose long salary and is not really going to be worthwhile for the Timberwolves if they're rebuilding. Taj Gibson probably isn't either, given how old he is, but he's someone who's probably at least a valuable contract after the way he played in the playoffs. The Timberwolves could flip him as well, so maybe a third team could get involved either before or after. So that's what I'm looking at for this.
We also have, again, we have the picks from the Deng trade, which I think would be attractive, more attractive than maybe the picks this year. I don't know. I assume they'd be involved. Mirotić would be involved.
And to refresh everyone's memory, that pick is from Sacramento, top 10 protected through 2017, and then it converts into, I believe, a second rounder if it does not get conveyed by 2017.
So the other thing that I wanted to ask you guys about is how Jimmy Butler fits into that. Because I think we talk about how, you know, other draft picks and all that, but the nice thing about Jimmy Butler is that he's a piece that can help both in the immediate and the long term for them, and the fact that they're not as constrained in terms of salary, depending on obviously what happens with Love. So where does he fit in terms of your willingness with, let's say, the draft picks and Taj Gibson in terms of ordering for you guys?
I think he would be behind Noah, obviously, would be I'd be least favorable to trade, but I would absolutely throw him in. Now, Jimmy and Taj and the pick, and that's too much. But, you know, if it's him or Taj, I would probably go with Taj to be traded. But, I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and say that they shouldn't trade Jimmy Butler for Kevin Love. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you on that. I would rather trade Butler than Taj because we don't have the evidence that Butler can even be an average offensive player, but more importantly, Butler is about to start making almost as much as Taj Gibson is, and Taj Gibson is another guy who would be great in reserve units. The fit with Love would be fantastic, with Love as sort of a beefier guy and Taj able to move his feet and block some shots. Love can control the defensive glass when they're all in there. I mean, with Noah, Taj, and Love, then you've really got a front court rotation. You don't even really need a fourth big man, and wings who are about like Jimmy Butler, who are making $6 million a year or so, or whatever we think he might get in an extension. Ultimately, I think those are less rare commodities than what Taj Gibson brings. But it's probably pretty close at least.
I think we have evidence that Jimmy Butler can be a decent offensive player. He was for most of last season. In a reduced role, but he was the most efficient guy on the team by a pretty significant margin. So,
yeah, all right.
If he can be forced to not take the shots that Derrick Rose should be taking, then he's a lot more useful. But
I feel you.
The other thing about Jimmy Butler is that I think his offensive negatives actually become less catastrophic when you add in an offensive powerhouse like Kevin Love at the four. I think that what he gives you, in a way, it would parallel what Golden State has done in terms of, if obviously Kevin Love is a far better player than David Lee offensively, but the idea of having a strong defensive three and a strong defensive five and having a shaky four in between them is something that can work in a system that's successful.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you guys is there's an unusual nature with Kevin Love because of the way the CBA works in terms of extensions that he can't formally really sign an extension at this point, though he could, I guess, conceptually commit to opting in, kind of like Dwight did. But would you feel comfortable without getting direct assurances from him that he will re-sign to do a deal like this?
No, but you still have to do it anyway. I'd be pretty terrified. There's a very realistic scenario in which he comes over. I mean, you know, he could. I don't know why he would say that he's going to re-sign unless the Bulls say, hey, we're not doing this trade unless you at least opt in for one more year and give up your early termination option. That might be an option that management could pursue like they did, the Clippers did with Chris Paul. But I think that it would be terrifying if he could still be a free agent because it doesn't make any sense for him to extend, as we've talked about beforehand, before he becomes a free agent, because he can get a five-year deal as opposed to a three-year extension once he becomes a free agent. And there's a very realistic scenario in which Derrick Rose just gets hurt again or isn't the same, and the Bulls end up, you know, being a pretty 48-win team or so with Love on the squad, lose in the second round, and he says adios, because he's now pretty much in the same place that he was with the Wolves, albeit in a weaker conference. So, I mean, you're almost doubling down on Rose's health to do this, and you're making a potential rebuild much more difficult if things don't work out this year. But I mean, if you can get Kevin Love on your team, and I mean, even just for this year, that I think the Bulls would be pretty darn close to championship favorites if Rose could look like in the preseason like he was back to some extent. So yeah, got to do it, I think.
I'm not entirely sure that they'd be that much worse off, depending on what they traded. Like, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about trading quite a few draft picks.
I think if there's no assurance that Love would waive his early termination option, or even that he'd sign an extension, then I think Mirotić probably shouldn't go, but I imagine the Wolves would insist. So it's tricky, but I think if he went to a place like Golden State or Chicago, or even Houston, he'd probably be a lot more likely to waive it. Just feeling like with what he'd want out of this, he just wants to compete.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about it to me is that we're in a situation where if the Wolves are looking to trade him, there are teams that combine the desired things that he's looking for, so quality teammates, a chance to win, even if you want to say a good city, and teams that have trade assets. And so in a lot of ways, it depends on how much force Love is going to put in. You know, is he going to narrow it down to a couple teams? Because he can do that in a lot of ways. And what do the Wolves want? Because as we've said, you know, there are a lot of interesting trade options, let's say, on the Bulls. And if they want to go more short term, if they want to get a guy like Taj Gibson because he's a good defensive player next to Pekovic, then, you know, if they're going to say they want that, then that's something that the Bulls can roll with. So it'll be interesting to see what each party wants in these negotiations.
It'll be really interesting to see, as you said, because I don't know if I would even trade Minnesota, even given what Love is. I don't know if I'd even trade if I were Minnesota, even given what Love has been saying about maybe wanting to leave in free agency, because, you know, you're just going right back down that same rebuilding path that they've been on for the last 8 years. This is a team that, by point differential, should have been in the playoffs last year in the Western Conference. You know, you could easily make the argument that they have 50-win talent. They can probably add, you know, maybe one more piece through the full mid-level exception this summer, maybe make some other trades. Who knows exactly what that would be. Maybe Gorgui Dieng gets a lot better, and maybe this team gets to be good. Now, on the other hand, there's a crapload of competition in the Western Conference, so even if they do get better, it's hard to see them being a team that's so good that Kevin Love is going to be like, oh yeah, this is a better situation than some other places that I might go. But really, maybe you take the 25% chance, 40% chance, whatever it is, that you get real good and he stays, rather than trading him just because credible superstars are so hard to find. And then you say, all right, if he leaves, you know what? We've got the cap space. So, you know, we'll just do it that way.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll add with that is the idea that what is Minnesota, if you replace Kevin Love with inferior players, and I think everybody's going to agree that whatever they're getting, unless they do really well, they're going to be inferior. How likely is it that they're going to make the playoffs in the West anyway? You know, is it that important to finish 10th in the West versus finishing 13th in the West? And that downside risk for them is, I mean, I just think that while you're getting assets, it's going to need to be something, to me, really good to do that. And it's the same reason why, or similar to why, Oklahoma City should never even consider trading Kevin Durant, because you're never going to do better than him in a trade unless you get lucky. And so what's the real risk there in that sense? So one of the interesting factors in all of this is there are a bunch of teams that are offered. I made a reference last night on Twitter that I think there are 29 teams that are interested in Kevin Love. But we can narrow that list down substantially. And what I was thinking about with you guys is, are there teams that have been bandied about that you think are less likely targets for whatever reason?
I think the Lakers are incredibly unlikely target. Just what do they have? What do they aside from their pick this year, what if anything would the Timberwolves even want? Would they want Jody Meeks? Would they want, you know, they would want Powell. Powell's not going to be back. They're not going to want Jordan Hill. Jordan Hill's nice. He's a fine player, but I don't think he's a centerpiece of a deal to get Kevin Love. And even if he goes there, what are you going to do with Kobe Bryant making $23 million this year and $25 million next year? Like, 37-year-old Kobe Bryant making $25 million isn't going to be winning any titles, I don't think.
I can understand the thought of teams like the Lakers and Celtics, or fans of those teams rather, thinking, well, we have a high lottery pick. That individual asset is probably as good as, you know, or better than anything that a contender could offer. But the problem is, once you look a little deeper, because there's Love can't really extend and it doesn't make sense for him to do so financially or to be in a winning situation, you've got now those teams giving up an asset to get Love. They're already bad. There's not really a realistic scenario in which a team like the Celtics or Lakers could get Love and then get to be good enough after 1 year to where he's going to want to stay. So then he probably ends up leaving anyway. And if you're management from a team like that, why are you going to give up a bunch of assets when it looks like Kevin Love might leave? And if you're Kevin Love, why would you opt in or say that you're going to stay there when, even if you go to a team like that, you're probably to be in the same boat as you were with the Timberwolves? So yeah. I don't think it's realistic that any of these lottery teams, other than maybe Phoenix, that's being talked about as a potential destination, that's actually going to come to fruition.
I would say it's slightly less or more feasible for, like, the Celtics. They don't have nearly the cap committed to someone like Kobe, and they're in the Eastern Conference, so it's plausible that they could make a run in, like, a second or third round with him. But, yeah, it's not likely. I don't see why both of the – I saw a lot of Lakers fans on Twitter making a really good, really simple point. Why would you trade an asset when you still, by all accounts, they would have a decent shot at him in free agency if he ever hits it? So why trade an asset now when you have just as good a chance of getting him when he hits the open market? I mean,
yeah, two things with that. I think the Lakers might have learned from Dwight Howard that trading for a guy early doesn't make them more likely to re-sign with you if you're LA, because that can take away the allure. I think that's a big factor. And the other factor with them is, if Kevin Love wants to go to the Lakers, he just shouldn't be traded, because then that keeps the asset, because the best thing selling point beyond them being the Lakers that they have for him is a early lottery pick that blossoms, because Kobe Bryant is not a major selling point for Kevin Love. Kobe Bryant's going to be gone after the 2016 season. And so he's not a selling point, so you're going to need something else beyond LA. And so if that's Andrew Wiggins, if that's Joel Embiid, whatever it is. So the Celtics, I think, are a little bit different because they have other potential selling points, and the fact that I don't know that Kevin Love is going to choose them outright unless they absolutely demolish this draft in a good way. So they might need to do the, okay, we're going to sell him. But to me, the Lakers, there is absolutely no reason that they should trade for Kevin Love.
None.
So then, given that, who do you guys think are the most realistic contenders for him with the Bulls? And I think we all agree that the Bulls are a front runner should they be willing to give up those assets.
The Bulls, Golden State, Phoenix, you know, the obvious contenders, the ones we've mentioned. I said Phoenix has a, I mean, they have just an army of draft picks, and they have a lot of space, and they were really good this year. And they kind of have a void at the four. Like, Channing Frye is a good player, but I don't think he'll be back. So, yeah, they're an interesting destination for him.
Yeah, I think you would have to look at the Bulls as a front runner if he actually does get traded, because they are the best intersection of assets and being able to contend if he gets traded there. And the Warriors don't quite have the package to put together, and Phoenix may not necessarily be good enough if he goes there. And Houston, I'm not sure what package they have if they're going to retain Harden and Howard. And that's about all the potential destinations I can really think of, frankly.
The only other one, because I'm an insane person, is if Bosch opts out and re-signs with the Heat, he could theoretically be a centerpiece at the trade deadline, which would be very interesting if Miami wanted to try to do that. Just because I feel like if any dominoes can break for Miami, it's going to happen. So that's the other one. But yeah, I think that the challenging thing with it is going to be what Love really wants. You know, does he want to get in the situation now? Because he's not going to get the security of an extension right now. We all know that. So does he want to be in the situation and get sold on it, or would he rather just get wooed a year from now? And we'll learn a lot about what he wants now, too. Okay, well, thank you guys so much for taking the time. It was great to have you on again to fill this little last void.
All right.
All right, man. Good to be on.
Thanks so much to both of our guests. We have Brian Schroeder of Hardwood Paroxysm and Bulls by the Horns, and you can also follow him on Twitter at COSMIS, as well as Nate Duncan of BasketballInsiders.com, where you can read him, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. That's NATEDUNCAN NBA. Really loved having both of them on. They both do excellent writing, both on and off the Bulls, and it was really great to make what the Eliminated Series has always kind of been something that can be recorded and put out at any point, but to make it really topical. And it was fun that it happened that way and that everybody really wanted to do it, and we found the time to do that again the day after we spent more than an hour on talking before that. So really loved having them on. We'll continue to do the series, as I always say. If there are people that you want to have on as guests, please submit them to me. You can hit me up on email at daniel.larue@realgm.com. That's my email. Or you can send them to me on Twitter at Danny LaRue. That's DannyLeroux. I really appreciate all feedback. And just as importantly, if there's somebody that you want to have on, you should let them know too. So maybe you can send them something saying, hey, you should come on Real GM Radio, and we'll get in touch. And we have had guests come on in that way. It's a lot of fun to get that kind of interaction. And as I always say, I promise that if you provide a thoughtful response, I will respond back in kind. I like to have dialogues and conversations, so that's one of the things that makes this so much fun for me, is to interact with fans. It's a lot of fun, and obviously the guests, everything else. So, assuming at some point we'll get back to a more normal guest schedule, but whenever an opportunity presents itself to do a podcast, I will do it, and I will make sure that it happens and try to get it out as swiftly as possible. It was so much fun to do this one. And we'll continue to keep going strong with the Eliminated and going on with topical pieces as well. Thanks so much. Take care and make it a great day.